The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab.
Mark Sudek is Director of Early Music at Peabody Conservatory, Artistic Director of the Indianapolis Early Music Festival, and a founding member of the Baltimore Consort. And Grammy-nominated lutenist Ron McFarlane has numerous recordings to his credit, and he is very much in demand as a soloist and a chamber musician. And when they performed together with Mindy Rosenfeld, they called themselves Gut, Wind, and Wire. And I have to start by asking you to explain the name.
Happy to do that. I've put a lot of weight on in recent years, so I'm Gut. And, no, we play gut strings, and I play wire strings, the cittern. The viola da gamba has gut strings. The lute originally was strung with gut. Mm-hmm. And let's see, Mindy is wind because she plays the wind instruments, but she also plays harp, which would have had gut strings.
Okay. And nowadays I'm not using gut strings so much as a sort of modern substitute, but carbon fiber, wind, and wire just doesn't have the same...
that sort of punk...
Exactly.
Okay, all right. But from what I understand, too, people have sort of a misimpression about what gut strings are.
Some people do. Yeah. The idea of cat gut, people will come up after concerts and say, does that really come from kitty cats? And it doesn't, but it's equally gross to a number of middle school audiences who have it explained to them that it really comes from the intestines of sheep, preferably lambs back in the 16th century. Mm-hmm. But I have a cruelty-free lute with no gut strings. Gut frets, however, which work terribly well on the old instruments.
Mm-hmm. So the instruments that you play primarily, are they actual early instruments, or are they reproductions?
Reproductions.
Yeah.
Okay. The plucked strings, especially the woods, are paper thin, and they just don't last for centuries the way thicker woods, violins, viola da gambas, mm-hmm. Will mm-hmm. last, and you can play on antique instruments and mm-hmm. have that wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. And each of you, all three of you, in fact, play quite a variety of, in some cases, quite unusual instruments. And some of them are very similar to modern instruments. People could look at you playing them and think, oh, okay, maybe that's a guitar. But there are also some quite unique and quite rare instruments that each of you play. And I wonder if you could maybe just talk about a couple of the more unusual ones.
There are. I'm actually the least versatile member of the group. I just play the lute or different varieties of the lute. But Mark's the real Renaissance man for different instruments.
Yeah, I can't play as fast as Ron, so I have to play a lot of instruments. Well, the cittern is my primary instrument, and it's not an instrument that people generally know. People that know Irish music know an instrument called the cittern, but it's really more of a bouzouki. It's an octave mandolin. But in Irish music, it's called the cittern. But the Renaissance cittern is a totally different animal. It's a very, very narrow neck with four courses of strings and a reentrant tuning, meaning the lowest pitch string is not on the end, it's in the middle. So it's an unusual tuning, and for the musicians in your listening audience, the intervals are a descending major third, an ascending perfect fifth, and then the most unusual of all, an ascending whole step.
Okay. And what would be the purpose of having it set up that way?
I have no idea. Symmetry was very big, and there's an alternate tuning in France for this instrument with a descending whole step, a perfect fifth, and an ascending whole step. So there's a sense of symmetry there, but those fingerings are even more awkward.
Hmm. They're the same open string pitches as a guitar, but rearranged, aren't
right.
they?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is very curious.
What else? What about like Lirone and some of the other unusual
Well, that's
instruments?
Annalise's instrument, okay. And that's a very unusual, exotic, beautiful instrument. 12 strings for every pitch, mm-hmm. and a very, very flat bow, so you can bow 3 and 4 strings at a time and play chords.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Lovely
that's an amazing
sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I see Mindy's not here to defend herself, but what about the crumb horn?
Well, I play crumb horn also
oh, you do?
With
okay.
Mindy, and
okay.
reluctantly, but it's a buzzy instrument because it has a double reed enclosed in a cap, so you don't actually have access to the reed. So you just blow this air into this closed chamber and cause the reed to vibrate and hope for the best. And it has just a range of a ninth, an octave and one additional note. So it's a very narrow range, and chromatics are very difficult, almost impossible to play. So we don't use those a lot, but they're good for effect.
Yeah. A ninth, that's the same range as a bagpipe.
Yeah.
Too. Ah. And that's another instrument that Mindy plays.
Right.
And there's one wonderful book called Nine Notes That Shook the World, which is an 18th century book for bagpipes. And that's probably my favorite title for a book ever. So that's why I just snuck it into the interview without having any reason whatsoever to do so.
Well, that was okay. That was a good thing to do. You know, one thing I notice is that there seem to be a lot of overlapping circles in the early music world. It's almost like a small town kind of feel, even though you're performing all over, literally all over the world with a lot of these ensembles and in smaller chamber groups. And I think I also notice something rather unusual related to that, which is that there's a tremendous amount of mentoring and collaboration in that, for example, you have taught some of the performers that you'll now be playing with. And I can't really think of too many other classical relationships where that is so common. You know, in other words, I'm a flutist. I don't think I ever performed professionally with any of my teachers. But there's something about Baroque and early music that has much more of a mentoring and collaboration kind of sensibility to it. Is that my imagination or is that true?
I think it may very well be true.
I think it's true also. I think it's a very collegial field, possibly because it started out with so few people. It hasn't risen to the level of cutthroat competitiveness. There isn't much money in this kind of music. People are in it for the love of it, for the most part. So I think that helps to encourage that sort of spirit. And so because we're so few in number, obviously we want to encourage young players, young bright players who are interested, and we couldn't be more delighted when they come to the point where we can actually be colleagues together. And I know Mark has some terrific students at Peabody. I'm looking forward to seeing them maybe as colleagues someday as well. But I think it's a field that has a very bright future and one that's been kind of a long time in coming, or a little slow in starting through much of the 20th century.
It's hard to imagine a teacher who would not want to play with former students.
Sure.
I mean, it's just so incredibly rewarding.
Sure. It just seems to be sort of rare in other areas of classical music, you know. You actually touched on something that I also wanted to ask about, which is that the reputation and the acceptance of early music in general by people who like to listen and maybe aren't musicians, and by other musicians as well. Do you think that the genre gets the attention it deserves and the respect it deserves yet, or is this still, we're still on the way up?
Definitely on the way up.
Yeah.
We're working hard at it.
Yeah. And you are literally hands-on grooming that next generation.
Trying.
But it has a huge, it's just come leaps and bounds over the last few decades. It's in a very different place than it was, say, 40, 50 years ago, in terms of mainstream respect. And, you know, when it used to be when you played, say, a Baroque piece of music on the air, the announcer would take special pains, if it was on original instruments, to explain that these really were on original instruments. And nowadays, it's the norm. You more often hear period instruments, or reproduction of period instruments, with period performance practice. That's what one hears more often than not on the radio. That's huge.
Yeah.
That's a huge change over the last several decades.
And in one sense, it's almost gone too far because there are so many modern orchestras now that don't play Baroque music in their concert series the way they used to. And I think that's sad because there's room for different interpretations for this music.
I know, paralleling that, I love to hear a lot of lute music on guitar. In fact, that's how I started playing lute, was playing the lute music on guitar. But so many guitarists are now thinking, oh, no, that's the lute's repertory. And I'm there going, come on, it can work.
Really?
It can work on the guitar.
Yeah. Just,
so it, very different dynamic.
Yeah, and I think that there has been, at least what I've seen in terms of the quality of the recordings that are available, not just the performances, but the recordings themselves on mainstream labels or in more recent years with the condition of the recording industry, with quality recording practices used, you know, not just the little Musical Heritage Society recordings,
yes,
but main labels.
Yeah. And just YouTube.
Well,
I mean, students now have this great opportunity to hear some of the greatest artists from Europe that don't tour the United States a whole lot, and they're all over YouTube.
Yes, to hear them and see them.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm. So you've both come to Cincinnati to play with Annalisa Papano and Cat Acoustic Consort, and then you'll also be collaborating at the Indianapolis Early Music Festival.
Yes.
And I wonder whether it's a challenge to, you know, be on the road, because you are on the road so much, in demand, all over the place, as a performer, but, you know, you have to adapt to, you know, different people you're playing with, so there's a different dynamic, there's different playing environments, different kinds of audiences and receptions that you have. What is that okay? Is that a hard thing to do, or is that maybe part of the fun?
Well, this one is very easy to do, because we have played with Annalisa and Joanna Blendolf before in this almost exact configuration, and it was just pure bliss. And our singer, Elizabeth Hungerford, is a graduate of the early music program at Peabody, so I've worked with her a great deal. And she worked professionally with Ron in his group Earhart as well. So this is a breeze. This is just going to be pure fun.
What about other gigs? What about transporting the lutes and sitarns and in the airplanes and things like that?
Some instruments are easier than others. My lute generally fits in the overhead compartment on an airline. Some of the bigger instruments, like a bass viol or a theorbo, there are plenty of horror stories out there of things that have happened in transit.
Yeah.
I hear these nightmares from the artists I book at the festival. In fact, Seattle Baroque just performed for us, and the entire continual section borrowed instruments from local musicians in Indianapolis and Bloomington, so they would not have to fly with theirs. We had a borrowed theorbo. The harpsichord, of course, he wasn't going to travel with his own harpsichord from the West Coast, but we borrowed the theorbo, the violone, and the baroque cello.
Much safer.
Yeah.
I was just talking with a lute builder and repair person a few days ago, and he was telling me about a colleague of mine who was tuning his theorbo in Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. Early Music Festival. It was just about a week ago or so. And the long pegbox extension of his theorbo fell off while he was tuning, the result of some damage that was done during, I think it was during an ATA inspection, but at any rate, during transit. But the full extent of the damage wasn't really apparent until he was actually at the concert. And apparently the Washington Post reviewer really had something to write about after that. But I'm so sorry about that. Those are rare and difficult instruments to come across and to keep in good repair.
Right, and to find someone who knows how to do it.
Yes, fortunately there is someone there.
So I'd love to back up the tape a little bit here, figuratively speaking, and find out from both of you how you got into this field, because I know, you know, the fourth grade teacher doesn't come around and say, would you like to play the lute or the violone?
Right. You
know, which of these two? So how did that happen?
Well, I got into it from the time-honored tradition of starting on rock guitar. It's amazing how many lute players started on rock guitar. And I was playing, you know, music of the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and Bob Dylan and all the music that nowadays is called classic rock and roll, to my chagrin. Anyway, I got from that into some folk music, and then got very interested in classical guitar, really interested. So I even went to school for classical guitar, and the music that I loved best on guitar were the arrangements of lute music from the Renaissance and the Baroque. So my classical guitar repertory filled up with lute music until it became pretty apparent where I really wanted to head. I played lute and guitar for about 6 months together before I realized I had to switch. And that's really where my heart was, in the old music. And never regretted it. It's been more than 30 years ago now. But the lute felt like a perfect fit for my psyche. And in a way, its music, especially the music of the Renaissance, blends some of the qualities that I've always loved about popular music and folk music with the sophistication and the sensitivity that you find in classical music. So it's a great blend of the qualities that I love in music.
What qualities of pop music are you referring to?
I'm talking about the sort of straightforward rhythmic propulsion of the dance music in the Renaissance. The fact that the scales are in modes rather than in major and minor. Some of the modes actually resemble blues scale and seem very familiar to me in that way. Also, there's a chance for on-the-spot improvisation. There's a kind of directness of expression available to someone, especially playing Renaissance music, that makes me think of folk music, of popular music that's current today.
That's great. And Mark?
Well, I have a similarly checkered past. I played in a rock group when I was a kid. I studied jazz for a year in high school. And after college, I did 2 years of nightclub work in the Virgin Islands. So, but in college, like Ron, I was a classical guitar major, and I was drawn to transcriptions of lute music. And that really is what did it for me, too.
Mm. Mm-mm-mm. So what were you playing in those rock bands and down in the Virgin Islands?
Electric guitar. Okay. And then in the Virgin Islands, I played an amplified classical guitar. And I just did kind of solo work and occasionally would be hired to accompany a singer who was traveling through. Mm-hmm. I got to do a six-week stint at a hotel, a luxury hotel that was hosting a CBS Wide World of Sports, a shark tagging competition. I was their entertainment for 6 nights a week. They were not a very good audience. Probably because they couldn't find any sharks to tag. So.
You have to find your own. They're not provided.
Yeah. There aren't that many sharks in the waters of the Virgin Islands.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Well, I'd love to double back again and find out, you know, one of the instruments on this particular program you're playing is Renaissance guitar. And I know that, you know, people will often sort of question, all right, well, so what's the difference between, you know, a Baroque guitar, a Renaissance guitar? How is that different from a regular old guitar that I have in my closet that I studied when I was a teenager? So either of you want to tackle that?
Well, Mark's I'm playing the Renaissance guitar.
Okay.
It looks just like a ukulele. It's the size of a ukulele. Guitars were much smaller up through the end of the 16th century, four courses of strings, either all four of them doubled or one single and three double, the way the lute has a top string that's single. Very small instrument, exact same tuning, equivalent tuning via the intervals as a modern guitar, the top four strings. If a modern guitarist wanted to play the exact pitches of a Renaissance guitar, you put a capo on the fifth fret because it's pitched a perfect fourth higher than a modern guitar because of the shorter string length. And then sometime in the 17th century, instrument makers were always experimenting, and the guitar got a little bit bigger, and they added a fifth course. And some composers wrote for guitars where both the fourth and fifth course were up an octave, so the lowest string was in the middle, again, that reentrant tuning that was common with a lot of plucked-stringed instruments. And I think it was around 1780 where they added the sixth string, and the string technology was such that they could shift from double strings, courses, to single, thicker strings. And then you have the birth of the classical guitar, which is still smaller than a modern classical guitar.
Mm-hmm. So they just keep getting bigger, really.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, audiences keep getting bigger in history. We shift from playing in salons to public concert halls. So all these instruments and the music undergoes this transformation.
Mm-hmm. I think the sound of those old guitars have a more transparent, more sparkling a little more treble-oriented sound than you think of a modern classical guitar.
The 19th century classical guitars, yeah.
But they are very intimate and very, very quiet. A lot of the early instruments are very quiet because of the, as you say, the salon or the small chamber music environment.
Mm-hmm. In France in the 17th century, there was almost a cult around the lute. And one writer said that the lute should only be heard by two or three listeners at most. And then at night, when the sounds of the city, this would have been Paris, presumably, it's when the sounds of the city have died down. So you're sitting there at close proximity, hearing just the most evanescent kind of wisping sound of the lute. And to tell you the truth, the lute is remarkably expressive at that level. And that's something you can never do in a real concert hall, a modern concert hall. But that was where they found the greatest musical and expressive value, was almost a one-on-one performer to listener relationship. Mm-hmm. And it changed over time. It was thought in time that the lute's relative quiet volume was a liability and may have had a lot to do with it finally falling out of favor toward the end of the 18th century. But at its height, I think people thought of it as a powerful instrument, not because it was loud, because it certainly wasn't, but it had the power to move people's emotions. And even though it was very quiet, you have a little bit of a dynamic range, a tone color range. A lot of expressiveness is right there, literally, at your fingertips. So it was a very important and very powerfully expressive instrument when it was at its height in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's turn the page here a little bit and not talk about music for a minute. And tell me what you like to do when you're not teaching or making music. Mm-hmm. How do you unplug from the music?
Okay. Well, I was going to say I'm already doing what a lot of people would just do all the time anyway for fun. Mm-hmm. So I don't often feel that I have to unplug from the music because I really love it. But I love to get out in nature. I love to get out to the ocean or to natural places. And I love to read, meditate. But I guess I just love a fairly quiet life. But getting out in the outdoors as often as possible is my idea of bliss.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
I'm an addicted runner. I owe my musical career to an Achilles tendon injury. I was a scholarship athlete in college and a state champion two-miler in high school.
Yay,
Wow. The jock and the musician. That's impressive.
Well, they're very similar. I mean, I was a distance runner, and you spend a lot of time training frequently on your own and getting into a zone, and it's like being in the practice room when you're starting out high school and college, spending a lot of time with your instrument, getting in your zone.
Mm-hmm. So. But no more running for you?
Oh, yeah, I run. I'm fighting many, many injuries, age-related injuries. But I try to get into 4 miles or so every other day and fantasize about doing more.
Great. Now, I've also noticed one other thing. You talked about a lot of lutenists who came out of the rock and roll guitar tradition. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed something about musicians, particularly Baroque and early music specialists, that have very, very broad tastes in what they like to listen to as well. And I will tell you that Nick McGeegan told me that he really has a naughty passion for punk music. And Keith Richards has said that he likes Bach. So if we confiscated your iPods, assuming you have iPods, what would we find on them that might be surprising?
Oh.
Traditional Chinese music, bossa nova,
and
lots of Beatles.
Okay, fair enough. And you?
See, I'm a big fan of Alison Krauss and Union Station. Okay. I think Jerry Douglas is amazing. Let's see, I think I have 3 or 4 Metallica albums on my iPod. And let's see, oh my goodness, a fair amount of old music, of folk music, various kinds, some chant. see, them crooked vultures.
Okay. And what do they play?
They just attack me.
Yeah. Wow.
No, that's a band with David Grohl and John Paul Jones.
Gotcha.
Who used to play with Led Zeppelin.
Right.
And others.
But not Wipeout.
Pray not. Okay. I guess that's saved for the safaris.
Oh, okay.
We did that as an encore once.
With Gut, Wind, and Wire?
No, Baltimore Consort.
Oh. So I do want to ask you about that, because you'd mentioned that Baltimore Consort has done some programs called Gut, Wind, and Wire.
Right.
But then you also have the group by that same name. So what's the...
It is confusing to people. But we were a trio when I was still a student at Peabody, and Mindy was a student. Ron was a student and then left. And we were the local members of the Baltimore Consort. Marianne, who plays with us, was up in Philly, and her husband, Lanny, was up in Philly. But we were the three local people that really loved to play together, and so we thought, let's get a trio going. And I think it was Mindy who came up with the name Gut, Wind, and Wire, and we played together for a couple of years in the early 80s, several years, and then Mindy left the group for quite a while. She moved out to Mendocino, and our trio kind of ended, but the larger group liked the name, and we used it for a couple of concert programs, and more recently, it's the name of one of the Baltimore Consort CDs. Mm-hmm. But about 10 or 12 years ago, Ron, you can correct me on the date, Mindy came back to us, which we were thrilled about.
Yeah.
And so we've resurrected our old trio, even though we don't live quite as close together. I live in Baltimore still, and Ron lives in Portland, Oregon, and Mindy still lives in Mendocino, California. So we don't do a lot of work, but we try to get together like for a week every year.
Mm-hmm. Will you do any more recordings, you think, or will it just be pretty much the road band?
Probably the road band.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you both so much for making time to chat today.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Wait to hear what you have next. So.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Thanks.